Well, our passage this morning is Romans chapter 11, verses 16 to 22. I'd wanted to go on to look at verses 23 and 24, but I will have to save those for next week. So, Romans 11, verses 16 to 22. And I want you to imagine that it's around the year AD 33. You're a Jew who usually lives in Rome, but it's the Feast of Weeks, otherwise known as Pentecost. And so you're in Jerusalem, and you're surrounded in Jerusalem by lots of other Jews, Jews from all sorts of places across the world, Mesopotamia, Judea, Cappadocia, Pontus, Asia, Egypt, Arabia, and many, many other places. And you've celebrated Pentecost every year of your life. Many times you've come to Jerusalem. But of course, this year will be different, because this is the year where you see 12 men with tongues of fire resting upon their heads, when you see a man speaking to the crowds about the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ, who died and rose only a few days earlier. And from that moment on, then, your life will change. Within several hours, you will be a baptized believer in Jesus of Nazareth, the Messiah. Well, sometime later, you return to your home city of Rome with your fellow converts. And just as the apostles taught you to do, you start meeting together on the first day of the week to worship Jesus. And weeks follow weeks, and months follow months, and the years pass by, and over time, others join your little fellowship. And not just Jewish converts, but now Gentile converts as well. And at first that was very difficult. How do we accommodate these Gentiles of all people in the worshipping of our Jewish Messiah? But you got over that hurdle, and you welcomed them in. And before you know it then, Rome has a growing church, perhaps several churches, Jews and Gentiles together worshipping the risen Lord Jesus. But then something happens. There are disturbances in the city of Rome. We don't know exactly what these disturbances were, but it seems like other Jews, not Christians, weren't happy with the spread of Christianity, and there's trouble for that reason. And eventually, around the year AD 40, and this is historically true, Emperor Claudius puts down his foot and he expels all of the Jews out of the city of Rome. The trouble is, of course, that that decree also must have included the Christian Jews. Presumably Claudius couldn't make enough of a distinction between those two categories. The Christian Jews, people like Priscilla and Aquila, who we meet in Acts chapter 18, they've fled Rome, they're living in Corinth, they've all been expelled as well because of this decree. And so you see, until Claudius's death in about AD 54, the church in Rome is now exclusively Gentile. And it's only in about AD 54 that the Jews start to trickle back into Rome, Jewish Christians like Priscilla and Aquila, who are able to then resettle in their old church or churches. And when they do resettle in those churches, there's a difference, because now more than 10 years have passed, and inevitably in that time the church there has changed. The original Jewish core and leadership have been replaced with a Gentile core and leadership, and the whole church just now feels different. The culture is different, the emphases of the preaching are different, the ways of thinking are different. The sense of humour afterwards is different. The whole atmosphere is just different. And perhaps many of these Jews find it very unwelcoming. Well, I tell you all that, of course, because it's quite possible, although we can't be certain, it's quite possible that is the kind of church which Paul is now addressing this letter to, Romans chapter 11. Now, obviously, some of what I've just said there is speculation, so don't take it as concrete facts. We can't say exactly how the Church of Rome developed in those first years. But Paul is writing a letter to a church in Rome in the mid-50s, at that time when those Jewish converts would have returned. Chapter 16 tells us that Aquila and Priscilla are now in the congregation. And we can see from Romans chapter 11 that Paul is concerned about the relationship between Jews and Gentiles in the church. Paul makes it clear in verse 13 that he's now speaking to Gentiles. He says there, "Now I am speaking to you Gentiles." And in particular, as we'll go on to see, he's concerned here with what he calls pride in verse 20 and arrogance in verse 18. It seems he's concerned about us Gentiles having an aloof, sort of self-entitled, proud, superior attitude over their brothers, their Jewish brothers and sisters in Christ. So what exactly does Paul say to us and to the Gentiles in the church in this passage? Well, he has two lessons for us. I originally had three, but I'm not going to deal with the last couple of verses. We're going to finish, as I say, at verse 22. And in that passage, then, he has two lessons for us to teach us. And the first is this. We need to appreciate our Jewish foundation. We need to appreciate our Jewish foundation. So what does Paul say in verse 16? He says, if the dough offered as first fruits is holy, so is the whole lump. And if the root is holy, so are the branches. What does Paul mean by that? Well, Paul's here using a couple of different metaphors. And in particular, he's going to develop this metaphor about the root and the branches. So that's the one we'll just start with here. What does he mean by this? What's he talking about? Well, the basic point's quite simple. Paul is saying that there's a natural relationship between a root and its branches. Whatever applies to the root applies also to all of the branches. He says in verse 16, if the root is holy, so are the branches. He's saying, look, if the branches of a tree are holy, that is to say, if they are set apart or special to God, well, it's only because they sprout from a holy, set apart, a special root. That's the basic idea here. And the same goes for his illustration about the first fruits and the lump. It's a little bit trickier, but basically, I think what he's saying there is, he's speaking about the Israelites offering up the first fruits of their land, or particularly the first fruits of their bread. So he's imagining a situation where the Israelites, at the beginning of the Jewish year, which was October, dedicates the first fruits of his labor to God, whether that be bread or wine or livestock. And in doing that, in dedicating that part to God, he's implying that God has special possession really over all of it. All of it, in a sense, is holy to the Lord, and that is seen in the fact that he offers this first part to God. And we see something of that principle in Numbers chapter 15 and Nehemiah chapter 10. I won't say any more about that, but it's the same basic idea. So let's go back to this metaphor of the root and the branches. What's going on here? What does all of this represent in Paul's mind? Well, simply, Paul is referring to the Church of Christ. And the members of the Church of Christ are the branches. And he goes on to say that there are two kinds of branches in the Church of Christ. In verse 17, he talks there about wild, ingrafted branches. And he talks about other natural branches. And very simply, the wild, ingrafted branches are us Gentiles, and the natural branches are the Jews. And as for this shared root from which both of these branches derive their nourishment, well, what's that? What's he talking about? Well, probably he's talking here about the Jewish heritage which we Gentiles have now been grafted into. What did he say back in Romans 9, verse 4? He said, they are Israelites, speaking of the Jewish nation, and he says, to them belong the adoption, the glory, the covenants, the giving of the law, the worship, and the promises. To them belong the patriarchs, and from their race, according to the flesh, is the Christ. So this root of the olive tree, I think it's representing that whole Jewish backstory, and in particular, the Jewish scriptures and the Jewish patriarchs and the promises which are made to those patriarchs and to their offspring. And Paul is saying that all of us, Jews and Gentiles, are in an organic relationship to that. We derive our status as holy children of God from that shared holy root, that Jewish foundation. And without that root, without that Jewish foundation, without all that we find contained within the Old Testament, without those patriarchs, without those promises made to the patriarchs, without all of that, we would have nothing. That is what we as Gentiles have been grafted into. But you see, here's the interesting thing. While both Jew and Gentile have now an organic relationship to that root, there is a distinction between those two branches. And the distinction is this, that the Jewish relationship is more natural than our relationship. You see, the Jew has been born into the literal offspring of Abraham. He has been circumcised at 8 days old. He is born under that covenant. He has been given and taught the scriptures as his special possession. He has sung those psalms daily. He has eaten and drunk and dressed and acted in line with the Torah. His whole calendar, his whole way of thinking about time itself is framed by those Jewish festivals and feasts. He has become fully encultured into that special heritage. From his birth, his thoughts and his feelings and his words and even his physical body have been moulded by all of that. And as for the Jewish believer, as for the Jew who believes in Jesus Christ, well, he is believing in the Jewish Messiah. He is believing in the one who has fulfilled this man's whole heritage and his whole worldview and his whole lifestyle and his whole culture. All of that has been building up to and has been fulfilled by the Jewish Messiah in whom he now believes. So that's the sense in which this Jew emerges naturally out of the root. He is a natural branch. But you see, that doesn't apply for us Gentiles. Look at how Paul describes our relationship in verse 24. He says there that if you are cut from what is by nature a wild olive tree and grafted contrary to nature. Our relationship is contrary to nature. Now, our relationship to all of those promises and that whole past, as I'm saying, it is organic now. We derive our life from it now. But it wasn't always that way. Because we Gentiles originate from wild olive trees. We originate from trees which are notorious for their fruitlessness. That's probably part of what's going on in the back of Paul's mind here, why he's picking a wild olive tree. Wild olive trees were regarded as being fruitless, not very successful, where it was the cultivated trees which were the most fruitful. And yet we've been picked from those fruitless olive trees and have grafted into that which now bears fruit. So for that reason, then, our relationship with that root wasn't natural. It was sudden. It was unexpected. It was traumatic. It was contrary to nature, Paul says. And so you can see what Paul is saying. And perhaps he is specifically now addressing the kind of situation in the church that we were talking about. You know, these Jews who have moved back out of the other regions back into the city of Rome in AD 54, and they're feeling like newcomers to this Gentile church. And Paul is saying, look, don't forget, you Gentiles, you are the real newcomers here. You are the ones who have been grafted into those Jews and that Jewish heritage, not the other way around. Verse 17, but if some of the branches were broken off, and you, although a wild olive shoot, were grafted in among the others, and now share in the nourishing root of the olive tree, do not be arrogant towards the branches. If you are, remember it is not you who support the root, but the root that supports you. And so this is Paul's first lesson for us Gentiles this morning. We need to appreciate our Israelite foundation, our Jewish foundation. And I do want us to remember this today. Part of what it means to be a Gentile Christian is to appreciate the fact that we now have this fundamentally Israelite foundation. Now, to be clear, that doesn't mean getting circumcised. That doesn't mean keeping the Torah. That doesn't mean obeying all of those requirements, dietary requirements or whatever else. No, Christ has fulfilled all of that, and we now live in this new epoch where we don't have to become a Jew in order to become a Christian. But at the same time, we do have to have a measure of humility about where the roots are here. It means accepting the fact that, in some sense, the gospel comes first to the Jew and then to the Gentile. It means seeing ourselves as newcomers planted into that root. And that can be difficult. Just as adjusting to a new country or a new climate can be difficult. But that's just what we have to accept as Gentiles. Accepting our Christ means accepting with him that whole backstory, all of the promises which preceded him, and the plan which he was part of, and the God of Abraham who sent him in the first place. That is what we are believing ourselves into. And so, do you see your Christian life in this way? Do you see yourself as having been transplanted into that Jewish root? Do you see yourself as a wild branch? Have you properly appreciated the fact that Christianity didn't start with us Gentiles? We have been engrafted. And it's quite possible that we struggle to appreciate that. People through the centuries have struggled. I mean, less than a century after Paul writes this letter, we meet a false teacher called Marcion. And Marcion taught that while the New Testament was a book which revealed to us a God of love, the Father of the Lord Jesus Christ, in the Old Testament we see the Jewish God. We see a God who was full of vengeance and legalism and was all about causing people to suffer. You see, for Marcion, being a Christian meant breaking free from that Jewish root. He was happy to adopt many of the insights of the Gentile Greek philosophers, but when it came to the Old Testament and all of that, no, that was unpleasant. That was primitive for Marcion, and he wanted to be cut away from it. He acted then as if he did not have this Israelite root. I remember speaking to a man from Zambia, and he said that many churches in his country described the Old Testament like a candle and the New Testament like a light bulb. And he said, look, when you turn on the light bulb, what do? You blow out the candle. That was the attitude which many churches had, thankfully not his. And I think we see something of that attitude in our own churches as well. An embarrassment about the Old Testament. I mean, after all, for us sophisticated modern people, the Old Testament world is very strange. It's a hard place to acclimatize to. And some people then, they look back at the Old Testament scriptures and all they see is a primitive and unpleasant collection of writings. They see violence and conquest and divine wrath and superstition and myths and laws about stoning people to death and not eating certain foods, and they don't like it. It doesn't sit well with their sensibilities. And I think that discomfort, it expresses itself in different ways, but for some people, the simplest thing to do is not to try and understand the Old Testament story on its own terms and acclimatize to it and submit to it. No, the simplest thing to do is to simply reject it, is to throw it out. And so they'll tell you then that, look, Jesus, he overturned all of that Old Testament stuff. He consigned it to history. He introduced something new and liberal and progressive, something enlightened, and he discontinued all of those savage laws and silly superstitions. We're free of all that now. And of course, there's some truth in that, isn't there? Because there is a radical discontinuity between Moses and Christ, between Old and New Covenant, between law and grace. And Paul has all of those features in the book of Romans itself. But we can't take that discontinuity and sort of absolutize it. No, because Romans 11 shows us that there is also continuity, vital continuity. And that is crucial. We Christians have this Jewish foundation. And that means that as Gentiles, we need to be ready to acclimatize to that and believe it and accept it as part of the backstory which takes us to Christ. Okay, that was perhaps a longer point than I wanted it to be, but that is our first point. We need to appreciate our Jewish foundation. Secondly, and finally, we need to avoid Jewish faithlessness. We need to avoid Jewish faithlessness. I suppose one of the reasons why Paul starts addressing Gentiles in verses 16 to 24 is because he wants to be even-handed in his approach to Jewish and Gentile Christians. So the risk is that Gentile believers will read chapters 9 to 11 and they'll use it as ammunition against their Jewish brothers. As I said before, it's possible that Jewish Christians at the time of this letter being written are coming back to a church which feels very different. And it's possible that people in that church are now complaining about how things have deteriorated since the Gentiles took over the show. And the risk is that in response to that, the Gentile now argues back and he turns to the Jews in the church and he says, look, you've got no right to complain. Look at what Paul says in this letter. Your people have rejected God. And in response to that, God has judged your people. And that's pretty much what Paul summarizes there in verse 19. He says, then you will say, branches were broken off so that I might be grafted in. That's what the Gentile is saying here. He's saying, look, Jews, you don't have any right to complain. Your people have rejected God. God has cut off most of the Jews from his tree. He's replaced them with us Gentiles. We've taken the back seat long enough. Now it's your turn. This is the age of the Gentiles, not the Jews. And actually, to some extent, Paul agrees with that. Verse 20, he says, that is true. Jewish branches were cut off and Gentiles were grafted in. But you see, Paul wants this Gentile to now be careful. In particular, he wants him to be careful not to become proud. And there's one very good reason why this Gentile should avoid being proud, and it's this. Because in becoming proud, the Gentile risks making the very same mistake as the Jewish nation he is now condemning. And that's what Paul now goes on to show us in verse 20. Look at what he says. He says, that is true. They were broken off because of their unbelief, or we could translate it faithlessness or unfaithfulness. The root word faith is there. That's the important thing. They were broken off because of their faithlessness, but you stand fast through faith. So do not become proud, but stand in awe. For if God did not spare the natural branches, neither will he spare you. So let's think about this for a moment. You see, for Paul, faith is the essential ingredient in true religion. And what is faith? Well, very simply, faith is that humble dependence upon God. It's that quiet inner allegiance to him, that simple posture of acceptance and receptiveness and reliance and embracing the Messiah and his salvation. And I'm at risk of overcomplicating it, I think, but it's that simple posture of the heart which puts ourselves into Christ. We place our faith in him. And at one level, it seems so simple, it seems so easy and so undemanding, but as far as the Bible is concerned, if you have that, you have everything. And the tragedy of the Jewish nation is that by and large, they do not have that. Chapter 9, verse 32, Paul says that the Jews fail because, unlike the Gentiles, the Jews did not attain righteousness. Why? Well, because they did not pursue it, he says, by faith, but as if it was based on works. There was a lack of faith in Israel. Indeed, for all those Jews were proud of their Old Testament and their heritage and their law, unlike many Gentiles often are, somehow most of them did not have the important component in all of that, faith. And Paul says here that they were broken off because of their lack of faith. In fact, it was almost as if their very pride sort of drowned out that faith. The picture we get when we trace the Old Testament right up until the days of Jesus is a picture of Jewish pride and presumption, both nationally and religiously, which kind of expels the need for faith in God. The Jewish pride says, we are the chosen people of God. We aren't like those Gentile dogs. In Jeremiah chapter 7, for example, the people of Jerusalem just seem to assume that this temple of theirs, it makes them immune to God's judgment. The Babylonians won't invade us. We've got the temple. The false prophets cry out, this is the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord. It's this pride, and it expels true faith. And then you have the scribes and the Pharisees of Jesus' day, and again we see this pride, and it's all about how they have the law, and how zealous they are about the law, and how they keep the rituals of the law meticulously. That's Paul. Before his conversion, isn't it? That's what Paul was like. And the tragedy is that somehow, in amongst all of that boastful, proud, obsessing over the law, all of those loud displays of piety and zeal, somehow amongst all of that, the essential ingredient has gotten lost. Somehow their very faith has gone missing, and they pursue the law. They pursue righteousness without faith. And of course, the starkest moment comes when Jewish pride and Jewish faithlessness actually results in the rejection and the state-sanctioned execution of Jesus, the Jewish Messiah, Yahweh himself in the flesh. So that was the fault of the Jewish nation. They had this pride and lacked faith. And Paul's point here is that the last thing we Gentiles should do is have the same attitude which those Jews had. They were broken off because of their unbelief, but you stand fast in faith. Therefore, do not become proud. Paul's saying, look, since it is only by that faith that any of us have salvation, don't you Gentiles now fall into the same trap as those Jews. Don't you now become proud. Don't you now become presumptuous about having God's favour. Don't you go around boasting that God has chosen you Gentiles over those Jews. Because it's that very pride, it's that very presumption that caused the Jews to be broken off from the olive tree in the first place. And I think this pride is something that we see in our churches even this very day. Haven't we all met those people whose faith seems to have more to do with love of country than it does with love of Christ? Haven't we met those people who speak far more about the Christian heritage of our nation and preserving that rather than they speak of Christ? Perhaps you have felt that kind of pride. Sometimes you meet Christians from other countries and they tell you about some great British missionary who you've never heard of, but they came to their region and they because of this missionary traveling to that region 200 years ago, now Christianity thrives to some extent in that country. And it's almost as if they're kind of complimenting you for this missionary. And you almost want to congratulate yourself on belonging to this great Christian country with this long missionary tradition. And you see, as you think that, you have this almost presumptive national pride. We Brits are God's people, you think to yourself. And I'm saying, I think we need to take heed against that kind of attitude. Because in many ways, that is the Gentile British version of the same Jewish problem. Then again, perhaps you've spoken to people who have come from charismatic churches and they have joined more reformed churches. I've spoken to several of those people in the last year. And they tell you about how they are so indebted to reformed preaching and how they maybe listened to it on the internet or something and they realized that this is far better than what they had before, and so they join a reformed church. And we think to ourselves again, don't we? Look, that's us proper, heavyweight, serious-minded Christians, reformed, conservative, evangelical. In the line of those great men of the past, Calvin and Owen and Spurgeon and Martin Lloyd-Jones. This is where it's at, we think to ourselves. This is true Christianity, and this is what we are part of. And once again, even in thinking those thoughts, we can find ourselves falling into the same problem. We can find ourselves adopting the Gentile British version of the same Jewish Pharisaic pride. And there really are people out there like that, people in our churches who possess a religion which is so proud, it's essentially faithless. A presumption based on heritage, based on clan, based on culture, based on a series of habits, based on a denomination, based on their own good works. And yet you burrow down through all of that, you tear back all of the layers, and you find that really true faith is absent. They're proud. Their pride has gotten in the way of it. And Paul does not want you to become that man or that woman. And he wants you to make every effort not to be. So let us bring things to a close then. So how then do we Christians preserve our faith? How do we avoid falling into the same trap as the Jews? Well, I want to finish this morning by looking at what Paul says there in verse 22. He says, note then the kindness and the severity of God. Severity towards those who have fallen, but kindness to you. provided you continue in his kindness. Otherwise, you too will be cut off. So this, I think, is what Paul wants us to do. If we this morning are going to be faithful, fruitful Christians, we need to be at all times holding these two things in our perspective. We need to be observing and noting the kindness of God, and we need to be always observing and noting the severity of God. We need to be looking up at our master gardener, the gardener of the olive tree. And first of all, we need to be reflecting upon the way in which he has grafted us wild branches into his tree, to the point actually where us wild branches now far outnumber the natural branches of the tree. And we need to see that, and we need to see in that the kindness of God. You think of Rahab living with her family in the walls of Jericho. And in a few days' time, those walls are going to tumble to the ground and that city is going to be wiped out. And yet, the kind God of Israel spares her and her family. You read that story and your heart swells with gratitude and relief. Or you think of Ruth, the Moabite, who just happened to be involved with that Israelite family during a famine. And the next thing you know, she finds herself under the kind wings of Yahweh. Don't you just thrill when you read that? You see the kindness of God. Or you think of Naaman, the Aramean. And through God's prophet Elisha, he finds himself also worshipping, going back to his own land, yes, but worshipping there, the God of the Jews. And again, we see the kindness of God. And doesn't it just amaze you then to see all of these men and women, branches snatched from wild olive trees, now engrafted into Israel. God is kind. We need to reflect on these stories and we need to see in them the kindness of God. And what we need to see then is that what God has done on all of those little occasions in the Old Testament and shown his kindness there, he has done now in an immense way for all of us. All of us here this morning are Rahabs or Naamans or Ruths or perhaps even Nebuchadnezzars. We are Gentiles who have been brought into the true Israel of God, and we should find ourselves being amazed and in awe of the kindness of God. We should allow that kindness to control our Christian lives. And we need to ask ourselves, how could we not continue in that kindness, as Paul says, given just how kind God has been? So we need to observe the kindness of God. But then secondly, we need to do something else. And it's not exactly a comfortable point for me to end this sermon on, but it has to be said because it's here in our passage. We need also to look at our gardener and we need to see that sharp knife in his hand. And we need to see the way in which he has also cut from that plant a great number of lifeless branches. And we need to think to ourselves, he is severe. He is severe. Verse 20, Paul says, "Do not become proud, but stand in awe. For if God did not spare the natural branches, neither will he spare you." Now, I hope you're not proud this morning. I hope you don't have that pride, that spirit of presumption, that pride in religion or nation or denomination or having the right habits or doing the right works or speaking the right words. Because if that is where your faith is, if you are proud in that, then you need to be careful. That attitude disguises itself as piety, but really it is the enemy of true faith. In verse 20, he says there, "Stand in awe." The word really is fear, of course. Fear God. It's the same word actually that Paul uses back in Romans 8 when he says that we haven't received a spirit of slavery to fall back into fear. Here in Romans 11, he's saying that we should fear. Seems like a contradiction. It's not always easy to explain these things, but I guess all we have to say is that it's not easy to explain the experience of man in the presence of his God. The experience of the Christian life is a deep and nuanced thing which language struggles to describe. But the simple point seems to be that while Christians shouldn't be haunted and gripped by fear, we should at the same time have that healthy fear, that sobriety, that clarity about who it is that we're dealing with. We don't want to mess around in the presence of the Almighty God. We are courting with trouble if we do that. And that is what we need to remind ourselves again and again. God's severity. You know, on Tuesday afternoon, we looked briefly at all of those occasions how when the Israelites sinned against God in the wilderness, in the book of Numbers, and we saw how God had dealt with them. He dealt with them severely, whether it be military defeat or poisonous snakes or the ground swallowing people up or fire from heaven or tens of thousands of people dying in plagues. He dealt with his people severely. And I need to say it, even if it disturbs us, you don't want to be playing fast and loose with that God. The Lord really did those things, and the Lord has not changed. His attitude to sin has not changed. His attitude to high-handed unbelief has not changed. His attitude to the proud has not changed. And so, if you find yourself feeling proud this morning as a Gentile Christian, if you find yourself being proud about the fact that God has chosen the Gentiles, if you're proud about your own nation, if you're proud about your own denomination, if you're proud about those things, watch out, because that pride might one day replace true faith in Jesus himself. And if that is you, and if you find yourself in that position, or if you think you're moving towards that position, let me remind you, God is severe. He will cut off the branches from his tree. So let us remind ourselves all this morning, we need to note together both the kindness of our God, he has grafted us in and we are indebted to that mercy, but we also need to remember his severity. He is a God who does not take sin lightly. He punishes it. He deals with it. And if there's any in his church who profess to have faith, but in reality all they have is pride, a day is coming when they will be well and truly cut out from his people. Let's take these things seriously. Amen.